This week, North Korea's ambassador to the United Nations, Kim Song, demanded that the United States release a North Korean vessel that is currently detained in the American Samoa. He added that any decision prolonging the detention of the vessel would imperil any future disarmament negotiations between the two countries. The North Korean mission at the United Nations in New York does not typically speak to the media. So Ambassador Kim's news conference underscored the seriousness with which North Korea was treating this issue. But why was there a North Korean vessel in detention in the first place? Our guest today is the author of the UN Panel of Experts report on UN sanctions against North Korea. He sat down with Korean Context to outline the current status of international sanctions enforcement and how Pyongyang may be getting around them. And the ship that the North Korean ambassador demanded returned plays a key role in all of this. With no further delay, from the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., I'm your host, Yong Kwon, and this is Korean Context. Hugh Griffith is the coordinator for the United Nations Panel of Experts monitoring UN sanctions on North Korea. He recently testified to the United States House of Representatives Committee on Foreign Affairs regarding the UN sanctions on North Korea and Pyongyang's efforts to evade them. Mr. Griffith, thank you so much for being with us today on Korean Context.
You're welcome, and it's a pleasure.
One of the questions that North Korea watchers have been focused on is the extent to which the international community can economically pressure North Korea. Some have suggested that North Korea would rather choose brinkmanship over what the regime might consider capitulation. Moreover, there are arguments that China might not allow Pyongyang to be pressured to the point where it would consider brinkmanship tactics. From the perspective of you and your office, do you see any signs that sanctions enforcement is having the intended effects both on the ground and at the negotiating table?
Well, I think it's worth noting that the only item on Chairman Kim's agenda at the Hanoi summit was the lifting of the so-called sectoral sanctions that were introduced in 2016 and 2017 in response to North Korea's unprecedented nuclear and ballistic missile tests in those years. So, yes, clearly sanctions are uppermost in North Korea's mind. There was no talk I heard of an interest by Chairman Kim in a permanent peace treaty with the United States or anything else. When it comes to North Korea, you have to follow the money, and the money is very tied up in the sanctions right now.
Speaking of sectoral sanctions, one of the key exports that is incredibly important to North Korea. And of course, one of the key commodities that your report also focuses on is North Korea's coal exports. Could you give us a quick overview of how important the mineral export industry is for North Korea as a whole, and specifically what role it plays in financing North Korea's weapons program?
The United Nations Security Council has been very clear on this. The resolutions, especially the later resolutions, explicitly state that the foreign currency revenue generated from the sale of commodities such as coal, iron ore, etc., is used to finance North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile programs. So that's what the United Nations Security Council is saying about how revenue is used from those sales.
One of the most critical lines within the resolution itself is the exemptions that are given to exports that are deemed, quote, solely for livelihood purposes and unrelated to generating foreign currency revenue for North Korea's nuclear or ballistic missile programs or other activities prohibited by the UN resolutions. This, of course, allows for the international community to still provide humanitarian assistance and to engage in North Korea in a way that punishes for bad behavior but doesn't hurt the public. However, at the same time, given the opacity of the North Korean state, how does the UN and its member states determine what is and is not for the livelihood purposes of the North Korean public?
In terms of exemptions now, all exemptions for, say, humanitarian aid have to be submitted to the Security Council 1718 committee to make a decision whether an exemption should be granted. back in 2016, in March 2016, Resolution 2270 provided some exemptions for coal, for example, if the coal was being exported and it could be shown that it wasn't being used for North Korea's ballistic missile or nuclear programs or companies associated with that. But since, because North Korea conducted additional nuclear and ballistic missile tests in 2017, Resolution 2371 placed a complete ban on the export of North Korean coal. So right now, there should be no coal exported from North Korea whatsoever, and any coal exports are illegal, except a few exemptions apply to exports via the port of Rafson, for example. But that's not North Korean origin coal. So there are a number of exemptions still carved out within the resolutions relating to humanitarian aid and things like the Rason port. And of course, the resolutions do allow for additional requests for exemptions in other areas to be considered by the Security Council 1718 committee. The resolutions are sophisticated, and the exemption process is built in there to allow for exceptions that may be judged by the Security Council 1718 committee. But right now, there's a complete prohibition on coal.
Right.
Iron ore and these other minerals, which previously were North Korea's top export items.
And we see some of the effects of the sanctions on the statistics regarding North Korea's trading activities. And one of the key developments that the news highlighted in 2018 was the apparent curtailment of North Korean exports to China, mineral exports, of course. And this is, of course, significant because China is North Korea's largest trading partner. But skeptics have also questioned the veracity of the data, given perhaps China's own political interests and in appearing to cooperate with the international community on non-proliferation. How much weight does your office give to this data?
We haven't used any Chinese customs data in our latest report, which is now available on the internet, our 2019 final report, which has been published as a Security Council document. So the last figures were in our 2018 midterm report, and those figures are attached as an annex to the report itself. But we are not using any customs figures in our latest round of reporting in the main body of the text. First of all, we're looking at the wholly illegal shipments, ship transfers of coal that's being shipped, petroleum product that's been imported through ship-to-ship transfers. We have a high evidence standard within the panel, but we do report on every violation that's supported by evidence that we have encountered. In addition, you won't be surprised to learn that whenever I travel to member state national capitals, I ask the authorities there, do you have any evidence of widespread systemic sanctions violations involving North Korea and any member state of the United Nations? And they give me their answers. And if those answers can be substantiated with evidence, they appear in the final report. If activities are going on, one would expect that certain member states would be aware of these activities, and I would very much hope that these member states would inform the panel and provide us with evidence or information that would allow us to verify this through satellite imagery, through documentation, etc., etc. So everything that we could substantiate appears in our final report. Obviously, we couldn't cover every case, but if the panel had been informed of widespread systemic sanctions evasion going on with a particular member state, even if it had been rather anecdotal, mm-hmm. You can be sure that as the lead investigator, I would have followed up on that. Most of the violations that I see are, except with a few countries in Africa and the Middle East, occurring without the knowledge of the government. And if we inform governments of what's going on, then generally they take action. And you will see in the reports in the last few years, we have seen shipments of coal going into member states where North Korean ships have been disguising themselves occasionally. But this is one-off. We haven't seen, nor have any member state reported, systemic violations occurring anywhere with the exception of international waters. So most of the coal transfers that we see, the satellite imagery and the information provided by member states, suggests that the North Koreans are concentrating their coal exports through ship-to-ship transfer in places like the Gulf of Tonkin. We also have a very important case of the Wise Honest, which is a great name for a North Korean coal ship, which was intercepted down in Indonesia with a large cargo of North Korean coal on board. And it's very important that that North Korean coal is seized if it goes anywhere else after Indonesia, because the resolutions are very clear. All North Korean coal is prohibited for export, irrespective of the country of transshipment. What we're looking at the moment, generally, is networks of businessmen trying to make a profit from the arbitrage, from the price differential of North Korean coal being extremely cheap now, since North Korean ships cannot simply sail into Chinese ports openly anymore, because that's illegal. And such ships can also be observed from satellites, and the panel is watching them through commercial maritime intelligence platforms such as Windward. So where violations are occurring, such as the case of the Wise Honest, which you can read about in our report, the North Korean ships are disguising themselves, taking on the registration of flags of convenience such as Sierra Leone, because they can't openly sail into the ports that service their former legal markets, because those markets are prohibited by the member state authorities from accepting such shipments. And we haven't seen, nor has anyone reported to us, any systemic violations except those occurring in international waters, where no member state currently has the right to interdict such North Korean vessels servicing other foreign flag vessels. That might change, but that was the situation up until submission of our last final report on the 1st of February, 2019.
That is an issue that I think a lot of news agencies have been very focused on as well, the ship-to-ship transfer of oil and oil for imports and coal for exports carried out by North Korea. It's an interesting effort by North Korea to evade sanctions. Do you have a sense for what percentage of North Korea's normal oil imports and coal exports that has been curtailed by the ongoing sanctions regime that the ship-to-ship transfer is able to substitute currently? The amount of materials that one is able to transfer on high seas is presumably much smaller than what they might be able to do it from port. Is that correct?
Well, there's some figures provided by a member state in our 2019 final report. They provide some estimates and the amount that could be imported by North Korean tankers from ship-to-ship transfers, according to the member state, is extremely significant. And we documented in our report a single transfer of 57,000 barrels of petroleum product in a single transfer to a vessel called the Yuktung, which had been disguising itself as the Mica, and the Yuktung had been designated by the United Nations Security Council for a port entry ban for supplying North Korean tankers earlier on. So a single shipment of 57,000 barrels of petroleum product valued at $5.7 million is more than one-tenth of the annual cap that's now set by the Security Council on North Korea's petroleum imports of 500,000 barrels of petroleum product per year. So actually, ship-to-ship transfers are significant in terms of the cap that the UN Security Council has set on North Korea. How much they're actually getting in, we don't know.
You mentioned earlier that the next step in terms of preventing ship-to-ship transfer might be interdictions on sea. But in your testimony to Congress, you also recommended the monitoring of the international vessel's automatic identification system. Could you give listeners a sense of what that is and how that might better help with enforcement of sanctions against North Korea?
Certainly. So it's really very simple. The AIS is like a ship's GPS. And if you've got the AIS switched on, except in limited dark spots where there's no signal to the satellites or the ground stations that monitor the AIS transmission. Outside these dark spots, these ships should be visible on maritime intelligence platforms such as Windward at all times. The problem is that whenever a vessel engages in an illegal ship-to-ship transfer, they either switch off the AIS or they falsify it in some way. So it's very simple. Our report makes recommendations to a whole range of actors, including flag states, these flags of convenience like Sierra Leone, like Tanzania, like Panama, which are not monitoring the AIS of the vessels that are sailing under their jurisdiction. So our recommendations is that flag states start monitoring the AIS of all these tankers in the affected areas of the East China Sea and elsewhere in East Asian waters. The insurers should start doing the same. The global and regional commodity traders, which use vessels to transport their products for ship-to-ship transfers, which are sometimes diverted to North Korea, should also be monitoring AIS transmissions and be screening historical AIS of the vessels that they seek to contract with. So if all these actors do that, then and AIS is kept on at all times, as it should be under the Safety of Life at Sea, SOLAS, the International Maritime Organization's treaty regarding maritime safety, then there would be less of a problem. Then member states such as Japan, the United States, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and the United Kingdom and France, who have some vessels, some aircraft in these regions photographing vessels, they would have a much smaller pool of dodgy ships to monitor. There would be the North Korean tankers, which we're all aware of. We know how many there are. There aren't so many. And then there would be a much smaller pool of foreign flag vessels involved. Why would it be smaller? Because they would all have their AIS switched on at all times, even when they were doing a legal ship-to-ship transfer. And there would be less recourse to spoofing. So at the moment, nobody is really watching these waters. None of the people who should be, which are the flag states, the insurers, the global commodity traders, right now it's just being left up to, you know, naval and intelligence assets of various member states to track these ships. And if you go to the East China Sea, you'll see there are a huge number of ship-to-ship transfers. And since the North Korean vessels are disguising themselves, it's more difficult to tell with absolute certainty what's a Security Council violation and what's just a case of a dodgy ship-to-ship transfer involving tax evasion or illegal fishing. So there needs to be more clarity, and international rules regarding safety of life at sea need to be followed. The North Korean sanctions just highlight the lack of global governance and regulation on the high seas in international waters, where essentially, unless you've got an issue like North Korean sanctions, which is under the media focus and of interest to UN organizations such as the one I work for, nothing is really covered. And on the high seas, you can get away with a lot, as we see with drug trafficking, human trafficking, smuggling at sea, illegal and undocumented fishing. So it's just symptomatic of a wider problem, which is that these flags of convenience just register ships, and then these ships can do essentially whatever they like on the high sea unless they're being watched for a specific reason.
I think you raise an important point about there needing to be broadly better global governance enforcement. I think another area where we have seen people discuss the need for better governance is in the cyberspace as well. And of course, North Korea has been very active in its cyber criminal activities. And this was also referred to in your report and also in your testimony to Congress. Of course, North Korea has been accused of stealing cryptocurrencies from South Korean exchange markets and elsewhere. But how useful is cryptocurrency for North Korea?
Well, we have no figures on the size of the cryptocurrency market. 2019 final report, for the first time, dealt with the issue of North Korean evasion of sanctions through cyber activity. And that covered a variety of fields, from, say, really quite significant theft involving banks in both the developed and less developed worlds, but also the use of various Bitcoin or Ethereum platforms to try and sell or buy ships. So from the report, you'll see that it's an important area, that cyber now generates a very significant amount of money for the North Korean regime. And indeed, some people have told me that cyber is now worth more in terms of foreign currency revenue generation than all the North Koreans' ballistic missile and conventional arms and military services sales overseas. And certainly from things like the Bank of Bangladesh heist and other cyber theft in South America and Southeast Asia, you'll see anything between $20 and $60 million being stolen in any single incident.
That's it for our episode this week. Thanks again to Hugh Griffith for coming on the show, and to you listeners for tuning in. You can find the UN Security Council report in the link provided in the description of this episode. We have an exciting event coming up. Next week, on Thursday, May 30th, we will be screening the documentary The Children Gone to Poland and conduct a Q&A with the director after the movie. It's an incredible story of 1,500 North Korean orphans who were sent to Poland during the Korean War, told through the eyes of their teachers and foster parents. The screening will be on Thursday, May 30th, between 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. at the KEI Conference Facility in Washington, D.C. You can find more details and RSVP on our website at keia.org. Hope to see you there!